There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello, Slate listeners. Do us a favor and help us make a better slate by answering our survey. It'll only take a few minutes. You can find it at slate.com/survey.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for March 5th, 2020, the Wash Your Hands edition. I am David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. I have not maintained sanitary conditions, not maintained corona hygiene, because John Dickerson is here in the studio with me, forming a disease vector, possibly. Hello, John Dickerson of CBS.
Oh my God, of the three of us, John is the least likely to catch the virus and the most fastidious, so you're in good hands being in John's company.
But John, I know,
but John's washed his hands more than both of us combined.
I've washed my hands a lot, but John is risking himself.
I'm the one who should be... I should be participating in...
He's touching the table right now, which is like touching my face, I think. Hello, John.
Hi. Hi, David.
Sorry for that graphic image. That other voice over there was Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University Law School from New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
On today's GabFest, the Democratic Party strikes back, catapulting...
Pew, pew, pew.
Joe Biden to the front of what remains of the pack. Thank you, John. That was good. Then the coronavirus pandemic, how it will shape the world, how it will shape politics, how it will shape the economy. And then a wild week at the Supreme Court. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. Before we get to our first topic, just a quick announcement. We talked last week about a live show that we plan to do at South by Southwest in a couple of weeks. Just an update that because of coronavirus concerns, we will not be doing that live show at South by Southwest on March 17th. So we are sorry to miss you, Texas and South by, but we will get you later. So dip me in honey. Invite the flies in to come eat me. How quickly things have changed. I had, of course, predicted something terrible happening to Joe Biden. And lo and behold, John, here he is. What happened? How would you describe the extremely rapid transformation of this race, the elevation of Joe Biden, the consolidation of the moderates, the revenge of the party?
Well, it's. I think this is true. I've been searching my recollection, as they say, the briskest, most amazing rags-to-riches story in politics that I can think of. We've had individual moments where people who were left for dead came back, but not the way. I mean, they were giving him last rites, and then he wins South Carolina. Then he wins 10 of 14 on Super Tuesday. The delegate math is Biden 527 to 475. That's undoubtedly likely to be surpassed by the time you hear these words in your ear. Bones, because California is still counting, and they will still be counting delegates in California until 2028. It's really amazing what happened. And briefly, because we'll paw through this in the whole segment, but basically what he did was he not only defeated Bernie Sanders, but he did so with a pretty diverse coalition. He increased turnout in places as opposed to Bernie Sanders, who's actually got a turnout issue. And I think the most important thing is that he convinced Democratic voters that he is the more electable and can beat Donald Trump. In Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, for example, if you look at the exit polls, basically about 60% of the voters said they wanted somebody who could beat Donald Trump. In those groups, Biden beat Sanders by either 20, 30, or 40 points. And the reason that's interesting is in national polling, public opinion polling, when you do head-to-heads, Sanders and Trump versus Biden versus Trump, it's all roughly the same. They beat Trump by a couple of points. So there's no numerical evidence that Biden is more electable than Sanders, but boy, has he convinced Democratic voters of that.
So, Emily, as John said, rarely has politics moved so fast in one direction. Do you think this was simply the anti-Trump anxiety coalescing, or was it part some sense of an establishment? The party actually has control and could organize people and marshal them into orderly voting patterns.
I mean, Biden has a lot more endorsements from people who represent the establishment in the party. So to the degree that voters follow those signals, and, you know, Klobuchar and Buttigieg dropping out was obviously part of that kind of momentum. I think the voters understand on some level something that lies beneath the head-to-head polls, John, and I wonder if you agree, which is that Biden's positions are just more popular. So, you know, on healthcare, on immigration, on a variety of fronts, if you're just looking at policy positions, Biden has liberal but well-tested positions, and Sanders has positions that are just not shared by a majority of the country. And I wonder if, you know, we're not going to get to run the experiment of having them both be the nominee. But when I look at them, I think as people really dig into this more and understand what this person's ideas are, will there be more resistance to Sanders because his ideas are just not right now as well accepted. So you have to both get the country to go for this guy who calls himself a democratic socialist and also to embrace policies like Medicare for All that, you know, whatever you think about the merits, and I happen to think like universal healthcare is a good idea, but the how you get there, the how realistic it is, the how big a departure it is from the status quo, those are like big ifs for Sanders. And Biden doesn't have those problems. He has other problems, but not those problems.
But John, I want to ask you the same question I just asked Emily. Was this a grassroots movement where voters sort of spontaneously of their own accord were like, oh, whoa, we got to do something about this? Or was this something because Klobuchar and Buttigieg dropped out, was it top down or bottom up?
Well, I think it's a combination of things. And I don't want to lose your point, Emily, about policy, so we'll come back to it. But I think what happened on Tuesday, what we saw in the exit polls, and this is across the country, which is interesting because a lot of times you'll get pocket results and then it's hard to extrapolate national messages. But the late deciders, and this is particularly true in Virginia where there was no early voting, the late deciders went in droves towards Joe Biden. Now, why did they do that? Is it because they were newly afraid of Bernie Sanders over the last couple of weeks as he started to do well? So this was a negative vote against Sanders. Was it that they were reacting to South Carolina? Joe Biden did well. Hey, take a second look at Joe. Or was it this extraordinary event where you had Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and Beto O'Rourke all come to Biden's support? Sort of, you know, they got together and built a bandwagon and then everybody jumped on it. What's interesting about that is that we've talked on this show, and there's been discussion in political science about this notion of the party decides. After the political parties lost their strength, there was nevertheless this view that there was a kind of a signal that party poobahs sent that ended up picking candidates. Hillary Clinton would be a perfect example. So there was no longer a top-down from a party, but the message got through. Well, Donald Trump destroyed that on the Republican side, and Bernie Sanders was doing a pretty good job, somebody who doesn't even call himself a Democrat, on the Democratic side. But the party decided on Tuesday night. And so I think it was both. I think it was both organic response to Sanders of the kind that Emily was describing, and then also clearly that signal that, you know, people we like, by we, I'm talking about voters who said, oh, I like these kinds of candidates, they were all rushing behind Joe Biden.
I think it is a mistake for moderate Democrats, for Biden supporters, of whom there are not that many. I mean, there are people who are voting for Biden. There aren't that many Biden supporters. I think it is a real mistake for them to assume that this is over or even close to over. Not because he's not in a strong position, but he's an appalling campaigner. You can imagine like some terrible stumbles. You can imagine him just like really botching stuff. I think that there's a sort of sense like, well, we're just going to agree. We're going to hold our nose. This guy's the guy we're going to settle for. But something could happen. He could have a health issue. There's so much. And for me, this remains the best argument for keeping Warren in the race, for keeping some other option. Because with a 77-year-old and a 78-year-old fighting it out, you know, and a disease, a pandemic raging across the country that's going to strike down old people, you can really see that this is not something a Democrat should be like, okay, well, now we can just go back and watch Love is Blind and not worry about anything else.
two quick reactions, and then one is he's not that unpopular. People may not rush out of bed, although, good gracious, they sure did in these polls. That's what's amazing, is that his turnout numbers are better than Bernie Sanders.
But but it's not because they're Biden. It's like, I love Biden so much. It's sort of,
I don't know what, there's more evidence in the contrary case.
Like, I don't think, I mean, this is true on like lefty Twitter. I don't think it's true in the world.
It's not lefty Twitter. It's not lefty Twitter. It's just like,
but it's, he did, he turned out voters better than Hillary Clinton did in 2016 versus Sanders.
I mean, it's like, people don't show up at his rallies.
But they showed up where it mattered, at the polling place.
They showed up at the polling place because they're voting, because they are very concerned, and they're voting out of concern, not because they're like, Joe Biden really turns me on the way Obama did, or the way Sanders does, or the way even Warren does, or Buttigieg does.
Like, I reluctantly am voting for him.
But
I think you've got it wrong, because if you look at Sanders, there's enthusiasm at rallies, but there's a ceiling. I mean, first-time voters in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada decreased. First-time voters decreased in those places. Yes. So, Biden again was the one who increased the vote relative to its previous time and relative to Hillary Clinton. So the evidence is, because if you were right, people were like, ah, yeah, Joe. They don't get out and vote if they think, ah, yeah, Joe. You got to, like, something's got to propel you. And it's not crazy to think that
it's
some portion
of fear of Trump. It is a desire to beat Trump.
But Emily, that could be powerful. Sorry. I mean, one way I've been worrying about this, and I'm sure other people have made this point, is that when you think of the wave of young people who are so excited about Sanders, and I mean, the generational divide in the vote was incredible, right? I mean, young people really going for Sanders overall, and older people going for Biden. The idea that those people have what it takes to, like, knock on doors and get out there and make it exciting, I mean, that kind of energy, David, I do worry that some of them are just going to, like, pull back, and then the organizing part will be less. Although I have to say, like, Biden won in states where he didn't even have a field office. He wasn't even campaigning.
Yeah, and in no state did people younger than 30 account for more than 20% of the electorate. So
yes,
they were big for Bernie. There are a few of them. And this is always what happens with younger voters. It's always what happens. It's why. Now, let's not take away from Bernie Sanders. He did make real inroads with the Latino community. He had a lot more trouble with African-Americans. But again, if Sanders' argument, I mean, this is a good night for Biden, but also there's evidence in all the contests so far, even the ones that Sanders has won, that his idea, both for his electability, but then also for his governing strategy, which is that he's going to he's arguing, I'm going to make such a movement, I'm going to beat Trump, and then change politics in Washington because of the size of the movement. In order for that to work in any of those three instances, you actually have to have a movement that is gobbling up voters and bringing in new voters, and there's no evidence that that's happening.
So I want to spend a couple of minutes on Elizabeth Warren, whose apparent defeat who as it stands now, John, she's still in the race, yes?
She is.
She's still in the race.
Hang
she's
on
gone.
A second. You're skipping over Mike Bloomberg, your guy who dropped out.
No, we'll get to him.
No, we're going to get to him.
We'll get to Mike Bloomberg. We're going to get to Mike Bloomberg. Okay. Don't worry. No, Elizabeth Warren's dislocation to third place and a sort of distant finishes makes me incredibly sad and angry. And I just want to register how sad and angry I am that she's smarter. She's like incredibly well qualified to be president. And I cannot, she is a victim of a sexism among voters and a fear among voters that they don't want a woman running. And it's just not fair. It isn't fair. And it's wrong.
Can I, including coming in third in Massachusetts, do you think that holds in her own state as well? So I can, or do you think that's all that that's at play?
It's strategic voting. Everyone is strategic voting, and she's a victim of it. And part of it is we want to coalesce around somebody who, you know, the candidate to beat Trump, and that means forestalling Sanders and any vote that isn't for that candidate who's going to win the nomination, which we now declare to be Biden, is a wasted vote. And therefore, even though I might like Warren, I know she's not going to win. But I don't want to undermine Biden by taking a vote away from him. That's part one. And part two is there's this strategic voting, which is people don't want to vote for a woman because they're afraid of what's going to happen if a woman runs at this time. They want it in safe hands. They want the safe person. It makes me sad. Emily, doesn't it make you sad?
No. It's funny. I haven't been feeling a lot of emotions about any of this. I've just been sort of watching it because it's so fascinating. I don't know what that says about me, but I think that you're
cold and dead.
Cold-hearted. It's true. I think you're correct about the influence of sexism. I don't think it's the only thing going on with Elizabeth Warren. I think there is a way in which her Harvard identity transcended her Oklahoma roots. There was a piece in the Times about this phenomenon this week, and I think it's right that the I Have a Plan for Everything, which like got her a ton of love from political writers and pundits and other folks like that, it even though she always tells these Oklahoma-based stories, and they are very real and authentic, and it is her experience, she, I think, still seemed to a lot of voters like she was more in teacher mode than in, like, Betsy Next Door mode, and that was part of why she didn't take off.
But why does she not get to do that? Obama gets to do that. Obama got to be that same professorial person and was allowed to be that and also be perceived as warm and exciting. There's something about being a woman that doesn't allow you to occupy both those spaces at once.
Yeah, I also feel like comparing people to Obama is like comparing people to like the god Zeus. Like he's just had such superior political skills to everybody else.
That's true.
Anyway.
Yeah. So I have a couple of questions about Elizabeth Warren because I think it's very interesting. One of the things that happened on Super Tuesday is three things that people thought might matter didn't. One is Mike Bloomberg's money didn't matter. Tom Steyer's money didn't matter either. Field organization didn't matter either because there are places that Biden had nothing and where he did very well. And plans didn't particularly matter, which is part of the Warren piece of this. What I wonder is on the Warren front, what you just seem to be describing, David, was both sexism, straight up sexism, and then sort of sexism by proxy, which is I'm not a sexist. I love Elizabeth Warren, but everybody else is, and therefore I'm going to do that. Question then is 33% of liberals in Massachusetts voted for Warren, self-identified liberals. 33% self-identified liberals voted for Sanders. Are those self-identified liberals who you would presume would be the most worried about sexism, the most untainted by it, maybe. Why are they voting against Elizabeth Warren? Is it all strategic? I'm trying to find out what, if anything, is else at play here, because I think while sexism is no doubt huge and probably the biggest knock against her, if it all gets written down to sexism, I think that's wrong. I think there's other stuff to identify, and I just don't.
Yeah,
I
agree with that. And I don't think you can fault the Bernie Sanders supporters for sticking with him. Like, I don't think that the choice between Sanders and Warren is a choice that's about sexism. Like, he stands for something really particular and strong, and he's been saying it for 40 years, and it's a ceiling, but it also means the people who are with him are really with him.
But for sure. And I mean, I'm just thinking about myself. I will probably vote in the D.C. Democratic primary. If for some reason, as the D.C. Democratic primary approaches and it's very close between Sanders and Biden and Warren is still in the race, and it's clear that Biden is going to need a little help to close the deal before the convention, even though I would much rather vote for Elizabeth Warren, I will vote for Bernie Sanders.
Ranked choice voting, so it wouldn't feel as stark a choice to you, and you'd be able to express multiple preferences.
Yeah. Let's talk about Mike Bloomberg, actually, too. So, Emily, $500 million, he got nothing out of it. Or did he get nothing out of it? Did he, in fact, weaken Sanders, who he really wanted to weaken, and set up an organization that can battle for voting rights, that can fight for whoever the Democratic nominee is going to be, as long as it's Joe Biden, I guess, and fight for swing Senate and House seats?
I mean, certainly he didn't spend that $500 million in the most direct way to accomplish things other than getting himself elected. He may have weakened Trump somewhat with some of his ads. He may have weakened Sanders somewhat. He has to be careful in turning over his organization to Joe Biden to not to violate campaign finance laws. Like, there were a lot of election law professors whose response was like, wait a second, how exactly do you plan to do all of this?
Campaign finance laws, which are really being enforced so well these days.
Why not just violate them, perhaps there might still be.
There's no FEC quorum. I thought there's no FEC quorum.
There is no FEC.
There would be a quorum for this.
No, I thought
no, they, I mean, wouldn't. Oh, I guess can't.
No,
can't,
I think I don't they think can't, can, literally can't do anything.
They can't literally
so David
can't do
has
anything.
A point. Yeah. Well, okay. Still, I don't know. Anyway, I have trouble because I have a visceral feeling of rooting against Mike Bloomberg, so I don't feel particularly dispassionate in my analysis of this. To me, it seemed like super embarrassing and deserved because his money was out there, his ads, well-produced, were out there, and he was terrible on the debate stage and, you know, too bad.
Also, one of the things we found from the exit polls is the more people got to know him, the less they liked him. He was the least popular candidate in many of these states. And it wasn't just mild dislike. He was very successful at breeding antipathy for himself. What's interesting in terms of whose vote he takes and all of the rest of it, in the exit polls, it also showed that Bloomberg almost certainly siphoned more votes from Biden than Warren did from Sanders. So now that he's out of the race, that's probably better news for Biden than if Warren got out of the race would be good news for Sanders. And the final thing is there's an interesting line, I think, with Michael Bloomberg, which is when he's not the face of his own movement, it does well, which is what they learned with gun safety, and that when he stopped being the face of it, it started to be quite successful. If he employs all of that organization and the knowledge that comes not just from being in the political space, but also being in the grassroots movement space on climate and guns towards beating Donald Trump, I think that's something Democrats who might otherwise not have liked Michael Bloomberg might want to reconsider as a useful weapon against a president they don't like.
That's a really interesting point, because he is that's a great point. He's very effective, and strategically he's used his money incredibly well. Someone was telling me, who was a kid who was volunteering on the Bloomberg campaign.
There was a kid volunteering on the Bloomberg campaign?
Yeah, was my initial response.
In Connecticut, he was just paying people who were then having meetings with local politicos, at which they said things like, well, Biden's good too. Anyway, go ahead.
But apparently the free lunches were insane. That it was like they had this Middle Eastern lunch that was like a feast, a Saudi royal feast. It was sounded great. He's an American hero. I think if he continues spending his money in this way on these causes and this way.
Okay, come on. He just spent $500 million on a failed effort to win American Samoa, and you're calling him an American hero and saying that he's spending all his money well? Like, come on, you got to recognize that this was ridiculous.
No, it was vain. It was an effort. It failed. It was not ridiculous. We've had this debate the last three shows. It's not hubris. The man was mayor of New York. He's eminently qualified to be president, and he botched it. He did a bad job.
Also, it's not crazy. Let's imagine that Joe Biden didn't, you know, that he continued to stumble or things didn't turn out well. There would be Bloomberg's viability as the alternative to Sanders would, out of necessity, seem less ridiculous than it does now that he's out of the race.
John, do you think there are people who never got in? I mean, I know it's so easy when they never got in, but like there's been this sort of nostalgia or wistfulness about Sherrod Brown, about Mitch Landrieu. I mean, Steve Bullock did try to run. Like these various more, well, Sherrod Brown's not a governor. I was going to say executive types who seem like they could have been the alternative to Biden.
Alternative to Sanders, you mean?
I'm sorry. No, alternative to Biden. Like the if Biden falls apart scenario.
Right. Well, alternative to Biden in the slot of alternative to Sanders.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think Sherrod Brown was really interesting because he kind of the argument people made for him is he could operate kind of in both camps. That he has a. And by the way, wait a minute. One of the things that about Joe Biden's victory on Tuesday night that is a challenge for Sanders is that in places like Virginia and Minnesota, in particular, which is interesting, Biden won with white non-college voters, which is to say blue-collar voters. Sanders talks all the time about how he's working class people's candidate, but if you add black and white to working class, Biden does better. If you look at just white non-college, he gives Sanders an absolute run for his money and sometimes beats him in places. The reason I say that is I was just thinking about Sherrod Brown. That was his argument, was that he could do well with working class voters. The thing is, for any of those other candidates you mentioned to be an alternative to Biden, they would have to basically have the pain threshold Biden had. I mean, staying in a race when you don't have much money and you're getting your ass handed to you across the country when you were supposed to be the electability candidate is actually a really hard thing. Not a lot of people have a lot of tolerance for that. So I don't know. Biden, you know, suffered through a lot and it's paying off for him.
I think the candidate we missed out on this race was Oprah. I really would have loved an Oprah campaign.
I would have loved it. Ridiculous and tedious. I really just that is ridiculous.
Oprah's run a lot more than Bernie Sanders has ever run. A lot.
I do not want someone who has
and has had a lot more influence over public debate than Bernie Sanders. Probably.
She has lots of influence over public debate.
She's actually been more of an executive than Joe Biden has ever been. Anyway.
Dear America, are you interested in what it takes to really make a good president? How much has celebrity taken over the office?
Oh, my God.
Available June 9th. Available June 9th.
Wait,
the
say
hardest
the title,
job in
please.
The world. The hardest job in the world. Thank you,
Thank
Emily.
Thank you. All right. By John Dickerson.
Oh, yes.
John Dickerson.
Right.
The Slate Political Gabfest. All right. Now my actual final question is. Is there, John, a strategy left for Bernie Sanders? He immediately turned to kind of a unification, like towards, you know, showing Obama in his ads, start to try to feel instead of trying to destroy the party, which had been kind of the message of his campaign, towards more a, you know, I'm part of the party.
Well, he's got kind of one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake because when he came, he's been saying.
I've been teaching my son to drive. He wants to do that. It's so terrifying. I'm
what
like, you can only use one foot. One foot.
The car.
You brake, but it's like not good.
Yeah. Because you're also sending the signal to the car that it needs to go forward. So, well, you know, he is still running against the establishment. He's still arguing that everything from the corporate media to the kind of entrenched Washington Democrats and lobbyists are against him, and so he's pushing away a lot of the elites in the party. And then on the other hand, as you say, he's talking about things that the Obama stuff in his ads is an attempt really to get at some of those suburban voters he's had difficulty with, try to make himself seem a little bit more palatable. But it's at odds with his brand, which is "Damn it, I am who I am, and that's why you like me." So, I think he's going after Biden quite hard on trade, on Iraq, on Social Security and Medicare, and I think that will devolve, I think, into something quite much more vinegary, and then we're going to get into a question of how ugly will it get, and will there be permanent damage? You know, Hillary Clinton's people are still quite sore that Sanders waited all the way till July, and so whoever the loser is on this, you know, they can make it pretty bloody.
John, I need a breaking news update. While we were just taping this segment. Warren dropped out. Reaction, Emily Bazelon.
You know, now I do feel sad. We are not going to have, in all likelihood, a female president in 2020. And I guess I sort of already thought that. But now it feels real. And that part really does make me sad.
Do you think it says anything about our politics and its ability to handle the detailed plans of the country he was talking about? You think about Governor Inslee, who ran on a pure global warming platform. He got nowhere. Does this say anything larger about the ability to talk about policy in detail and whether that really gets you anything in a campaign?
Right. I think its chief value is signaling. Mm-hmm. Like the idea is not that people actually want to hear what you have to say about policy. It's they're like, oh, wow, this is a person who's capable. But then she did get hung up on – the problem was then when she went too detailed around Medicare for All, it really put shackles on her. And it was a mixed blessing. I think the planness didn't matter as long as no one was reading the details of the plan. It just signaled this is a really capable person. So that would be my take.
It got her a lot of momentum last spring, right? I mean, a lot of press coverage, a big push. There was a moment where she was soaring in the polls. And then I think it wasn't enough. And maybe that's because of her position on Medicare for All. Maybe it's these other less tangible factors we are talking about, or just the fact that Sanders supporters proved to be really, really loyal to him. I'm not sure. But it does signal that, like, the plan is not the chief thing.
Let me ask you that, but you both this question, which is if you are Elizabeth Warren and or someone who has her interests in mind, what is the route that maximizes your ability to influence the things you care about? Do you go with Bernie Sanders, who's cared about the same things his whole life, but who also has a lot of his own ideas about that kind of thing and might, if he gets elected, would be maybe a competition with him to get those things done, although you might work hand in hand and go forward with that, or sign up with Joe Biden, who wouldn't mind your support right now, for the promise of position X in the administration, you'd have to fight against a kind of more moderate, slower group of people. But presumably, you're in a position right now to ask for something. You might be able to lock in a position that would give you influence. What do you guys want to do?
Ladder.
I mean, head versus
second.
Heart.
Yeah, the second Biden, obviously, which is head. I'm not even sure that's her head. I'm not sure. Her heart might be with Biden too, for all I know.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think her heart's with Biden at all. But I do think when I imagine a Biden administration, it would be much better for progressives if Elizabeth Warren had a powerful position in it.
I'm not so sure that we couldn't have a woman president in 2021 because I think there's a non-zero possibility that one of these candidates dies. I'm just saying. Like Trump, one of the Democrats, and the woman running mate gets the presidency. Just saying.
You are
the usual plot's reliable prediction.
We'll see.
Slate Plus, you get bonus segments on the GabFest and other Slate podcasts. You go to slate.com/GabFest+ to become a member today. And today we're going to talk about pandemic fiction that we like, representations of pandemics in the culture. Speaking of pandemics, COVID-19, the coronavirus, threatens to be a global disruption unlike anything the world has seen in our lifetime. I think supply chains have been disoriented. The world economy is grinding slow. Gatherings across the world are stopping. Travel is slowing down. More than 300 million kids are out of school around the world. The pandemic has spread across continents and is now clear with, I think, more than 10 deaths when I wrote this, that the disease has a strong foothold in the United States and is spreading quietly and probably inexorably through our country. So, Emily, we have talked about containment. That would seem to be the strategy the United States was pursuing, prevent the disease from getting here, make it get here much more slowly, get here only in a controlled fashion, stop anyone who seems to be showing signs of it from getting in the country, contain them, quarantine them. That containment no longer seems possible. So what does that mean for us?
It means that we really should have had a plan B, and we should have been thinking about the alternative strategy of mitigation, which means testing and treatment and quarantine. We should have been thinking about that all along. I hadn't really read very much coronavirus coverage for about a week. I'm not someone who I resist long tail risk. I'm sort of like President Trump in that way. I would prefer that it all just be minimized. But that seems like a huge mistake in this case. And it just seems like the combination of the president's resistance to talking about not even worst case scenarios, just like poor scenarios, combined with the fumbling at the CDC where they botched the original testing kits and didn't send them out and had very narrow criteria for who got tested. Like now we are really at much greater risk than we might have been. And I couldn't help but connect this to a piece that George Packer wrote in The Atlantic that went online this week about the kind of crumbling of the bureaucracy and this feeling that it's taken a while for Trump to really destroy parts of the bureaucracy. Packer was writing about the Justice Department and the State Department, but I feel like it's proving to be true about Health and Human Services and maybe the CDC as well, where you see instead of a sort of science fact-based what's best for the country response, you see people trying to placate Trump, who wanted it all to go away, and you see all this incredible infighting in a way that has made the government's response much less effective. And I find that really alarming and upsetting.
Well, Michael Lewis wrote a whole book about this called The Fifth Risk, which is all about the growing incapacity in government for project management, because when things get politicized and when incompetent people are running things and when science and sort of logic and analytical reasoning are thrown out the window, all those things are lost.
And you know, David, when we have presidential campaigns, we only care about the guy at the top. But it turns out being president means you run an organization. And we never talk about that kind of stuff, Emily. Available June 9th. Books at retailers near you. You know,
great.
The thing about Michael's book, which does exactly what you say, David, but what has been the case in the Trump administration so far when we've talked about systems breaking down or norms breaking down. The evidence, or oftentimes it's theoretical, with the exception of what happened at the border with family separation. Although that, in that case, the family separation was an acute policy choice made in the moment. What's different about this is it's a long-term thinking that is required in an administration about what are the biggest, most important things that can ruin my life. When I interviewed Condi Rice for the book, she said what you should ask every candidate is what surprising thing is going to hit you and what are you going to do about it? Because that's what being president is. And if you don't think about that beforehand, you have this kind of situation. So what happened here is you had not only before you ever get to the actual way in which the administration responded to this specific challenge, the National Security Council's pan flu group, or their plan for handling pandemics, was shrunk. The staffing was cut, and that group was set up basically in the wake of Ebola to try to deal with these kinds of global issues, which basically become a national security threat, and at least have somebody ready there for this kind of thing when it happens to start all the kind of coordinating that you need to do between all the different, it's a very weird way to say coordinating, across all the different kinds of agencies. So you're weak. The structural stuff you're supposed to take care of when nothing bad is happening is weak. And then when it goes bad, this over-politicization of the response and the constant weakening of public trust in the president, which is another one of those long-term erosions that now has a problem. And the down, and what happens now is this isn't just about some norm that's been transgressed. This is about, you know, human lives and safety and the economy as well. I mean, there are real things that can be counted for the decisions that were being made.
I want to say that I do think that the Trump administration has handled this terribly, and all the criticism that is being heaped on them for both the structural bad response and the particulars of the bad response and the lies and the misleading, all well deserved. There's a whole other piece of this, which is that we have a health system which seems maximally designed to not deal with this in a strong, good way. So a whole society, people don't have sick leave. So they keep showing up at work even though they don't feel well. They're afraid to use their benefits because they have such high deductibles. They show up to get tested for something and discover they're negative for this but walk out with a gigantic bill. They're not going to want to go get tested, where it's a non-centralized system so that tests don't get distributed, so that information doesn't get shared very well. I mean, there's the maximum way that this could go wrong, it's going to go wrong. I mean, I think it's in contrast where you look at countries that have highly nationalized top-down health systems are probably going to handle this outbreak a lot better. Now, there may be other things they don't handle as well, but I think there's a reason why we should be particularly scared in the U.S. It's a health system that doesn't have the resilience and the capacity to deal with this, and in fact scares most people are scared to be in it. They don't want to be in it because it costs them so much money.
Totally. And that compounds all the weaknesses John was talking about. And then on top you have Trump, you know, Wednesday night going on Hannity saying that he has a hunch that the death rate is far lower than the World Health Organization believes, suggesting it's okay for people to with coronavirus to go to work. He like mixed it up with the flu at one point. I mean, come on. Like, this is a real thing that is going to kill people. And it doesn't matter whether Trump turns out to be right or wrong about the lower death rate. The point is, like, right now, you go with caution. You go with the scientists.
Staying with what Emily is saying for a moment, David, your point is exactly right. And there's a downside to thinking so much of this is a result of Donald Trump, because then what you end up doing is when you assess what went wrong, you just say, oh, it's the idiosyncrasies of the Trump administration and there are systemic issues. And if you want a self-interested reason for universal health coverage, it's that if other people are in the health system and are habituated to seeing their doctor as a part of some kind of universal health care, it's easier for them when they feel symptoms to go through whatever their channel is to health care, which therefore presumably mitigates some of the risk. Whereas if you've got 27 million people that haven't had health insurance for a year, you've got a system that can't very quickly manage these kinds of problems. But to to your point, Emily, you know, when we have a hurricane coming, we've become used to seeing the president sitting in a room getting briefing. He's wearing a rain slicker with the presidential seal on it. And the idea there is he's getting a bunch of new information, and that all information is going to help him make decisions, or at the very least turn him into the best public administration officer, public information officer. In this case, you have the president, who has been briefed, presumably, saying three or four things that are not just factually bonkers compared to if you're a regular person, but also having talked this week to health experts, they're just totally wrong. And in this case, it's not just wrong because the way he's wrong about tariffs and who pays for them, but in this case, he's spreading information that is actively hurting the efforts that his entire administration and the entire world are moving in direction A, and he is moving in direction Z. It's kind of extraordinary that that this is happening, and because people have become kind of used to it with the Trump administration, we should think about how far this is from what we normally expect from a president in times of crisis.
It's clear this disease is going to enter our population at scale and will spread. And as I understand it, the best metaphor I've heard, or the best description, is we want to flatten the curve so that what we want is to make sure that not everyone gets it at once, that rather it gets spread out, it happens over time, so the hospitals aren't overwhelmed, so that a certain number of people are getting it, the sickest people can get the hospital care, those of us who don't get very sick are able to take care of themselves at home. You want to distribute it, and so that it becomes much more like the flu, the seasonal flu is, where there will be lots of deaths and lots of people affected, but it isn't massively overwhelming. And the best way to do that is less contact, more hand washing, less large gatherings, people staying home when they're sick, doing the hygienic mitigation, not exposing old people and very young people, well, old people especially, to lots of interaction with each other. Are we as a society disciplined enough to carry those things out? I mean, we've discussed this. We've just canceled a live show that we were going to do because of this. Or is, as a whole, is the nation ready for this and capable of it? Is it capable of it?
I mean, I think we're capable of it. I have some real doubts right now. I don't want to add to the sense of panic by speculating, because I feel like I just don't really know the answer, and we're just going to have to see.
You know, we lack a channel for modulated response in our lives, and particularly in our public lives, where somebody with authority, it should be the president, because they're the most popular person in America, or the most well-known, I should say, not the most popular, but they are the most well-known person in America, who can distribute useful, informed information in the public good. That person is not playing that role. And what the difficulty is, both because of the role the president has played in the previous 3 years undermining public trust in traditional institutions, and also what he's doing in real time, because now somebody's being told by their HR department, if you don't feel well, don't come into work. And they hear, but the president said it's fine if I go into work. Well, that's actively undermining what needs to take place, David, for what you're talking about. And so I think our capacity is shrunk, and also by the time we might go, oh gee, maybe we really should start listening, it's quite late, because it's incubating, it's spreading through the community, it's snowballing, and this is the cost of having an inability to kind of be measured and say, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. And that's not being panicked, that's just being prudent.
Do you guys touch your faces a lot? I don't even know if I touch my face.
Oh, my God. I touch my face constantly. Ugh, totally.
I am not a constant face sesher, but in this moment of heightened mindfulness, I find that I rub my eyes a lot.
Yeah. Actually, now I think if I do, I rub my beard.
Have you all been engaged in commerce with other human beings in which the handshake has been put
gone,
aside for something
gone.
Else?
Elbow bumps.
Elbow bumps. Yeah.
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 I love a fist bump, but I'm not sure if fist bumps are okay.
I don't think they are. I mean,
they're probably not better.
No, I think, but
still flesh, right?
If I could just get someone to weigh in on this, we've all been taught to sneeze and cough into our elbow, but then if we're all elbow bumping, then aren't we
Well, you don't cough into your outer elbow.
Do you think it all stays contained into the crook of the elbow?
The outer part is very well protected.
What I like is the foot kicking.
I bet you people bowing just didn't touch each other because they were spreading all those germs. Like, maybe that's what bowing curtsies were about.
They didn't know about the germ theory until 100
years ago. Maybe they sort of did.
But
it's not that hard to figure out that if someone sneezes on you, you might be able to get sick.
Oh, my God. They totally didn't figure it out. They weren't that – they did not know it.
No, that's why they would go from the autopsies to the surgery room and kill everyone.
Yeah. I guess that's true.
Or the morgue. Sorry, the morgue.
They were bleeding all over each other. They're leeches.
I like in Wuhan, they're kicking. They like touch feet. It's basically like they're kicking an imaginary soccer ball.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah.
We're
playing like an imaginary game of hacky sack. You do, but I think coordination in the social space is good. By the way, as somebody who's been a fan his whole life of social distancing,
you're in heaven.
I'm with you on that.
I realize this isn't something to joke about, but I did when that word started. I started to see that word showing up a lot. It took me a moment to process it.
I'm finding it painful. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th. Only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
There is a lot going on at the United States Supreme Court, Emily. There's a lot of social distancing there, too, I suppose. They took a huge Affordable Care Act case that they'll hear arguments on in the fall. I guess before – they'll hear arguments before the election, right? I think so. Maybe not.
Not clear. It's not scheduled yet.
Yeah, maybe they'll schedule it so they don't. That would be typical. And then this week they heard an argument on one of the most contentious important abortion cases we've had in a while, a reprise of a case that they already decided a couple of years ago. And then there's a little rebuke of Chief Justice Roberts, rebuking Democratic Senate leader Schumer for remarks that he made. Schumer just walked them back, I noticed, on my headline feed.
Good.
Why don't you start with this abortion case, Emily? What is it? Why did they hear it? And where does it look like it's going?
This case is called June Medical Services versus Russo. It's from Louisiana. Louisiana passed a law requiring abortion providers, that is doctors, to get admitting privileges at hospitals within 30 miles of their clinics. This is identical, effectively, to a provision in a Texas law that the Supreme Court struck down in 2016. The reason the Supreme Court struck the Texas law down is that the American Medical Association, the American College of OBGYNs, like everybody, says that there is no health benefit to women from doctors having these admitting privileges. Why? Well, one reason is that if you have a complication from an abortion, you just go to the emergency room. You don't need your doctor to have admitting privileges. Like, you can get the care you need without them. The second reason is that abortion, statistically speaking, is incredibly safe. So in this Louisiana case, out of the thousands and thousands of women who've received abortions at the three existing clinics in Louisiana, only four have ever been admitted to the hospital. And indeed, one of the reasons that abortion-providing doctors have trouble getting admitting privileges is that the hospitals have a rule that you have to have a certain number of patients admitted every year to make it worth it to them to extend this to you, and they don't qualify because their patients don't go to the hospital. So that's like a sort of lovely catch-22 in this. The really interesting moments at oral argument on Wednesday involved Chief Justice John Roberts. So Roberts voted with the conservative minority in the Texas case to allow Texas to continue this law. On Wednesday, however, his questions repeatedly to both sides were about whether the benefits of the law could differ from state to state. In other words, if you have all these national healthcare experts weighing in and saying there are no benefits to women's health, could that be different in Louisiana than in Texas? And no, the answer was no. And the Louisiana Attorney General and the Trump administration lawyer who were arguing in favor of the law kept trying to assert yes, but they didn't have any evidence. And so if Roberts truly cares about that, then he would vote with the liberals to strike down Louisiana's law, respecting precedent from the Texas case.
So just to understand the chain of logic there is. So the Louisiana law is the same. The benefits, the so-called benefits of the law would be the same in Louisiana. In Texas, the Supreme Court has already decided those benefits don't justify the law in the case of Texas, even though Roberts disagreed. He thought it did justify it. Roberts is simply, even though on the merits he believed the Texas law was legit, the merits of the law are not as strong as the fact that the Supreme Court – there's a Supreme Court precedent in against the law.
Well, actually, Roberts didn't exactly say he thought the merits of Texas's law were okay. He voted to uphold it based on a number of related issues. The other part of the argument is about the impact of the law, right? So there's like, is there any benefit? The answer scientifically is no. But then there's this question of impact, like will Louisiana's clinics have to shut down because their providers won't be able to get these admitting privileges? Two of the three Louisiana clinics say, yes, we will have to shut down. Part of what happened at oral argument that was also interesting was the justices Sotomayor, Ginsburg, Breyer, they were – Kagan and Roberts, I mean all of them, they were really read up on the record. And so they were asking very specific questions about the particular doctors involved. Had they made sufficient efforts to try to get these admitting privileges? And the Louisiana Attorney General seemed like she was not super familiar with the record. She was asserting facts that were actually at odds with it. And that probably did not help Louisiana.
Emily, are there direct assaults on Roe coming that the Supreme Court will hear? Because this is not a direct assault. This is a sort of indirect, let's undermine it, weaken it.
Yeah. So one of the most interesting aspects of abortion politics and law right now is a split among pro-lifers. So there are pro-life strategists who, for decades, have been arguing that this incremental erode Roe tactic is the way to go. Let's claim that abortion actually hurts women. Let's try to marshal evidence that will support wrapping clinics in red tape like this admitting privileges law and shut them down that way. And this
sure seems
like
to be working. It sure seems like the real good strategy.
Well, it has seemed like a good strategy, except that it failed in 2016. Justice Kennedy didn't go for it. If it fails now with Roberts, I think that will be the end of this strategy. And it'll be interesting because it's quite an elite strategy. Like, it's the lawyers, the litigation folks, not the grassroots anti-abortion movement. The grassroots anti-abortion movement is all about the heartbeat bills, which are like, let's make abortion illegal, you know, when women are 6 weeks pregnant, they don't even know they're pregnant yet. Like, that's the end of Roe. And, you know, there's some people who think that what Roberts doesn't like about this Louisiana law and the strategy behind it is it's all about deception. It's asking him to say, like, oh, don't look at all this medical evidence and, like, look at this pretext we've created for you. Isn't it lovely? If Roberts doesn't go for that, and it's kind of like how he didn't go for it in the census case, potentially, I mean, he could still change his mind. Let's just make that clear. But if he doesn't, then it's going to be full on like, okay, well, let's just present a case to him that says abortion is wrong. This was a terrible mistake. It has always been a mistake all along. And we're going to try to present the court with a kind of a straight on attack on access to abortion and the constitutional right to abortion.
Is there a useful inconsistency, or maybe this is a nitpicking, but if your pretext is that you're concerned about the health of the mother from the abortion doctor's medical skills, implicit in that is that the process is kind of going forward. So you're choosing to have your argument further down the road for people who are not in support of abortion rights. And therefore, implicit in that is that it's kind of okay to have gotten that far down the road, that everything would be okay if you just had doctors who had admitting privileges and everybody could be safe once this procedure took place if something were to go wrong.
Yeah. I mean, Justice Kavanaugh sort of took that line of questioning on Wednesday. He said, well, imagine a state where all the doctors have an easy time getting admitting privileges. Wouldn't this law be constitutional? Because then it wouldn't be an undue burden on women's rights. And that suggests exactly what you were saying. I mean, I think the sort of stealth tactic is that in states where there's hostility to abortion, the local hospitals don't grant the admitting privileges for a variety of reasons. But yes, you're right about the indirectness. And that is in some ways a political problem. And I think that's why the grassroots pro-life movement has been reluctant to sign on to this. It just feels to them like it's conceding way too much. Like, wait a second, this is murdering babies. This is bad. We should leave this up to the states. And there already are those heartbeat bills passing. The question will be how to tee up the next case for the Supreme Court.
Are the people not getting admitting privileges really just doctors who perform abortions? Or does it actually end up sweeping in a whole other set of doctors who don't perform abortions? Do they really just end up targeting this because they want to stigmatize those doctors?
Oh, it's targeting these doctors. It's a requirement for performing abortions. And so part of the scientific resistance to this is that there are all kinds of riskier procedures that doctors are not required to have admitting privileges for.
Chuck Schumer said, I can't even remember exactly what he said, but he said
something about
things
you're going to pay a price to Kavanaugh and Gorsuch in an individualized way. It was bad.
Yeah, that they reaped the whirlwind and now they're going to they unleashed the whirlwind and now they're going to reap the whirlwind or something. Anyway,
you sow something and then you reap the whirlwind in the Bible.
Yeah, I guess Kavanaugh said something about sowing the whirlwind in his confirmation hearings. But yeah, Schumer went after them personally. It was, I think, a real mistake. I hated to see him do that.
Well, he has said it was a mistake. He said something like, oh, I misspoke or misinterpreted, whatever it was.
He shouldn't have done it. And, you know, I will say, I mean, I think that Chief Justice John Roberts was like well within his role to scold Schumer about it. It also should be said, though, that last week Trump was criticizing Sotomayor and Ginsburg personally, and Roberts didn't stick up for them. Now, Trump's comment wasn't the kind of pay a price sort of rhetoric that just seems really dark, but it was hypercritical. So, I'll let listeners think about whether Roberts should have stepped in that instance as well.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. Emily, you have been talking so much about the Supreme Court. When you're having a drink, surely you just want to relax and talk about some great TV show you watched or some book that you're reading or some funny thing your kid said. What are you going to chatter about today?
I'm going to chatter about another Supreme Court case because it was
what?
A really important case. Another really important case was argued this week. This one involves the independence of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This is, of course, the agency created to protect consumers that is Elizabeth Warren's baby. Republicans hate it. And they have gone after it by arguing that the way Congress created it was unconstitutional. Congress said in an effort to protect the Bureau from politics that the president can only remove its director for cause, defined as inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. And the argument is that this limits the president's power too much. The argument at the court was noteworthy for two reasons. One is that there are a lot of other examples of federal entities created with for-cause firing. They don't happen to be single-head agencies the way the CFPB is, but does that really matter? So given the precedents that have allowed the court to uphold those previous appointment structures, liberals on the court, like Justice Kagan, seemed very skeptical of the claim that this one is unconstitutional. However, Justice Gorsuch, who is a big believer in vast presidential power, got quite testy with Paul Clement, who was defending the structure of the CFPB. And this is kind of interesting because Clement is normally like a hard-charging lawyer for conservatives. But in this case, because the administration took the Trump administration took the very unusual position of refusing to defend a law that Congress has passed, Clement was appointed to defend the structure of the CFPB. And Gorsuch just got really testy with him in a way that seemed kind of surprising and showed that, like, emotions are running high among the conservatives, probably against this agency. So, you know, this is a wonky question, but it's going to have a big impact. If the way that the CFPB's head is appointed is unconstitutional, it's possible that the Supreme Court could just say, like, goodbye to this agency, which would be really dramatic expression of judicial power. So we're going to have to wait to see on this one.
Well, and also just a further step towards the coming executive dictatorship, where the president, the unitary executive, has total control over the executive branch and all of its agencies in some shockingly unlimited way, and where it also doesn't have to answer to Congress. So that's where we seem to be.
That is very well said. I'm glad you added that. Thank you.
John, what is your chatter?
Well, I have two chatters. The first is a new podcast called LBJ and the Great Society, and particularly as we're talking about well, what's a presidency for? It's a really in-depth look at Johnson and the efforts to expand healthcare access and fight poverty and basically all the Great Society programs that were ultimately swamped by Vietnam and also some of their own internal challenges. But it's hosted by Melody Barnes, who knows something about this, who is the chief domestic policy advisor under the Obama administration. Anyway, I recommend it to anybody. And the other one is a piece that I read in Outside Magazine. It's How a Shipwreck Crew Survived 10 Days Lost at Sea. I always find those kinds of stories deeply fascinating because it's really when the total veneer of civilization gets pulled off, what do we resort to and how do we behave? My view is, given the expectation that that might happen, why really go out on seafaring vessels?
100%.
And now, of course, they're just huge petri dishes when you do it in a cruise context. But anyway, it's a well-written piece. It also has a very interesting ending, which I liked. Some very colorful metaphors or at least descriptions of what happened on this one particular voyage. So Eric Barton is the author, How a Shipwreck Crew Survived 10 Days Lost at Sea, on OutsideOnline.com.
I do not understand how humanity made it to any of these islands. Why we're not just all just living on the continent of Africa? Like, why would we ever have? I guess you could get to Europe and Eurasia without crossing an ocean. But man, why bother? Not worth it. Don't do it, guys.
David Plotz does not like the water and never will.
My chatter is an alarming story. It's actually the flip side of a story I talked about the other week about a plant that people hope would be a CO2 sink that you could plant in sub-Saharan Africa. But a story in the Washington Post about rainforests, tropical rainforests, which have been long relied upon as huge sponges for carbon dioxide, and that there is this way in which when there's more carbon dioxide in the air, it prompts growth in tropical rainforests. And so there's like more lushness, more growth, and these forests serve to reduce the huge baleful effect we're having by pouring so much CO2 into the atmosphere. And it turns out that that effect is declining rapidly. So it used to be that rainforests absorb 17% of the CO2 we put out. It's now down to 6% and falling. And the reason is that drought and heat are making it harder for trees in these tropical rainforests to grow as well as they had grown. So even though there's more CO2, which should help them grow, the drought and heat is countermanding that order. And it's very alarming. It's a really alarming. And it's a study that was done under incredibly difficult circumstances in African and Amazonian rainforests. And it's terrifying. Listeners, you continue to send us very nice chatters this week, a lot of really good chatters that you tweeted to us at Slate Gabfest. And I'm going to mention one from Chip Nold, who points us to a piece in Vox about Norman Rockwell. And Norman Rockwell, who apparently in the 1960s and early 70s underwent a kind of late life transformation, possibly abetted by a second marriage that he made, where he became much more conscious of inequality and racial inequality in the country, and became almost more radical in his present depictions of American life in ways that also made him unwelcome on the pages of some of the magazines which he had been famous for doing covers for over many decades. So it's a really good piece about a person who came to a change, a political change late in life. Usually people, when they get older, get more conservative. Norman Rockwell did not. If you enjoy the Gabfest, please subscribe to the show. You'll get new episodes the minute they are published, maybe a minute later, maybe 2 minutes after they're published. I don't even know. In any case, you can get that wherever you are listening to our podcast. You can surely subscribe to it there. Please do that. That is the show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Jocelyn Frank. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Rosie Belson helped us here, John and me here in D.C. And Dan Cody, new Gabfest community team member, is helping Emily in New Haven. Welcome, Dan. Gabriel Roth is editorial director of Slate Podcast, and June Thomas is managing producer. You should follow us on Twitter at Slate Gabfest. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I am David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. I just realized I described myself as being from Atlas Obscura. I'm not from Atlas Obscura anymore, but we'll leave it in. Fix it next week. Hello, Slate Plus. How are you? You probably have lots of time to listen to podcasts. I hope you're not sharing your ear pods with anybody. I hope you're keeping those separate. I hope you're listening alone in a sealed chamber so that you're not getting the germs of anybody else. But the coronavirus made us think about all this kind of pandemic culture. There's been a lot of pandemic culture in the world over the past couple of generations. Zombies are a form of pandemic culture, if you think of zombification. But there are been a lot of books. There's been TV shows. There's been movies. And I wanted to talk about favorite bits of pandemic culture and why they spoke to us. Anyone have one they want to start off with? John?
Well, you all are much more well-read than I am.
True.
And so the road is
so
the only...
not true. I'm
off in a little room of the. You all are much more. You have a much more breadth. It's but now that the book is done, I'm going to be coming in here talking about popular fiction. I'm going to be talking about cookbooks I've read.
The you guys aren't show on Disney Plus.
Yes, I'm going to be so interesting. Anyway, the road I can't remember. Is it a pandemic or is it cannibalism or something?
Well, I don't think it's pandemic because I think the disaster that is described in The Road is not a pandemic. I think it's like it's not ever specified, but it seems to be nuclear. It seems to be – it's environmentally destructive to all the plants and animals too. And it's I think there's a description of bombs. I did think about – I mean The Road is the book that affected me most in my whole life.
I know. I don't want to go back and reread it for fear that it won't. Yeah. For fear that it won't be the first
time.
Oh,
God.
I want to reread it for fear. Right. I don't want to go back and reread it for just for pure fear.
You know, there's something you said, David, 15 years ago, I think, when I once said that there was a leak in the house. And you said it's like having a spy in your house, which is you don't know where these pandemics and in this what I think the propulsive force in this literature, which I haven't read and am now about to make a judgment on, is that it can be everywhere and anywhere, and it's stealthy, and it gives everybody a hunted feeling, but you don't know where the arrow's coming from, and so it reminded me of what you said about having a leak.
That was a good metaphor. I don't remember saying that.
It stuck with me, but anyway, so. Now
The Road is the best of those books. It's so terrifying.
Station 11 is also really good. I mean,
but not so grim.
Yeah, less grim, but in some ways that makes it, I mean, I think The Road is an amazing book, but the thing about Station 11 is because it's more in this gray zone in which people are still trying to live and travel around, it seems more possible, right? Like, my response to The Road is, like, I want to be the dead wife. I also don't want to imagine my children suffering, but, like, I have no interest in living in a post-apocalyptic universe, like, zero.
Right.
Whereas Station 11, it's more like, could you still find some reason to survive here because maybe it will be okay in the end?
GabFest fans, that was just a teaser. To hear the rest of our Slate Plus conversation, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a Slate Plus member today.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.